Good afternoon. This is Bill O'Brien. Well, with you on this Tuesday afternoon, this bright, sunny here in southern West Virginia, bright and sunny Tuesday afternoon. I understand I have a brother in New England who is shoveling snow again. They've had 6 to 10 inches of snow up in the Boston area, and a little bit more snow than that north of the Boston area. So winter's not over, even though spring starts officially tomorrow. Glad you could be with us today on this, our second program, in this, our second week. And it is very, very exciting for me to be with you and to talk about the Constitution and think about the Constitution. I have to tell you that as many different things as I've had my grubby little fingers into in recent years, the thought every afternoon of being able to sit down and focus exclusively on the Constitution and on the founders and on the ideas and the thinking and the quotes and the, you know, the literature. I have, I'm sitting in, surrounded by books that I've read over the years on the Constitution. And I, as the, you know, as the time approaches to go on the air at 4 p.m, I look at these books and I say, oh, I gotta get it back in and reread that. I haven't looked at that stuff for years, you know. And, today, as an example, I picked up a book that I read probably 10 years ago, by Gordon Wood, in it's entitled, The Making of the Constitution. It was an award winner for him. At the time I read it, I believe that it was probably the best resource, the best book that I had ever read on the Constitution. It's just rich in sources and quotations and citations and all the rest of it. And last year, excuse me, last year, lo and behold, we were fortunate here in West Virginia. The West Virginia Humanities Council sponsors a guest lecture every fall. And this past fall, the speaker was the author of a three-volume biography on Theodore Roosevelt, Edmund Morris. Edmund Morris. And a friend, Keith Lilly, and I went up to Charleston, West Virginia in October and listened to one of the best lectures on Theodore Roosevelt that I'd ever heard. The lecture the year before that, in the fall of 2011, was on the Constitution of the United States, and it was one of the best lectures that I had ever read ever listened to on the Constitution, and it's based on this book on the making of the Constitution. And I thought it was one of the best books that I had ever read. I looked at it today, and I thought, oh, I got to get back into this. It's about 750 pages long, but I thought I've got to get back into that book. And I looked at my copy. And it's all dog-eared, and it's all marked up with pens and red pens and stars and notes and everything else, you know, just trying to highlight quotes and everything else. I get so excited about the thought of focusing on this subject for our What I'd like to do next Monday is begin looking at the Federalist Papers, and specifically the big one, if you will. There are 85 Federalist Papers, but the one that everybody talks about and the one that everybody focuses on is Federalist Number 10 by James Madison. And the reason for that is that in that particular Federalist Paper, in Number 10, Madison explains how the Constitution of the United States is going to work and how it's going to solve the problems of the Confederation period as he defines them. So what we have is an interesting situation. We have James Madison, excuse me, we have James Madison laying out in 1786 and early 1787, in a document that he wrote to friends of his called Vices of the American Political System, And he lays out what he sees as the major problems of the Confederation period that need desperately to be reformed. And then in the spring of 1787, the Constitutional Convention meets, and in that session, Madison presents to the delegates assembled in Philadelphia in late May 1787 what the textbooks refer to as the Virginia Plan, which is his program for fixing what he sees as the major problems of the of the Articles of Confederation as he has laid them out the year before in his Vices in the American Political System. And then, of course, the convention meets throughout the summer of 1787, and there are debates and discussions and need for negotiation and a little bit of give and take here and there. Madison, in a number of areas, is really reluctant to give in, to give any ground on what he sees is the, you know, as the needs of the system. Finally, on the 17th of September, the convention adjourns with a draft of the Constitution of the United States, which is the Virginia Plan with all the amendments and changes that have been made to that document throughout the summer of 1787. And then the nation launches into we launch into the ratification struggle as the Constitution is presented to special delegates of the people in each state to basically make the decision as to whether the Constitution will be ratified or not ratified by that particular state. And when the ratification struggle reaches the state of New York, Madison, once Virginia has ratified in June of 88, Madison goes to New York and joins Alexander Hamilton and John Jay, and they begin to draft what are the very famous Federalist Papers, which are 85 editorials that appear in the New York newspapers urging ratification of the Constitution. And all three, John Jay, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison, author of these documents. They signed them all the same under the name Publius. And so for years, historians played a game as to try to identify which Federalist Papers were written by which of the three gentlemen. And Federalist number 10 is clearly Madison's, and part of the reason is because in his Vices of the American Political System, written the year before, Madison had shared with friends and colleagues his analysis of what he saw as the major problems, the major defects in the Confederation, in the structure of the Confederation, and the kinds of changes that would be necessary to fix them. And we know that Federalist number 10 is so close in language to the Vices that we know that Madison is the author of Federalist number 10. It's probably the most famous of all the Federalist Papers. It's the one that I'd like to begin with, if for no other reason that it kind of reinforces what we've been talking about over the last few programs about the nature of Republican government generally and the kinds of changes that the Constitution makes in it. And Madison explains in a very, very, I would say, evasive way how this document is going to work. I would suggest one other thing that is more directly related to what we've been talking about in our program, especially yesterday and the last program last week in the auto letter. It seems to me that Madison's Federalist number 10 is a classic example of what Otto was reporting to Virginie in October of 1786 on the very evasive language that those advocating changes in the Articles of Confederation were using in order to communicate with those people that supported change, and at the same time to explain these changes in ways which the general population would find it very, very difficult to understand. Madison's Federalist number 10 is a classic example of that. It is written on a level that is very, very difficult to understand unless you are tuned in and you know exactly what the issues are and what Madison's strategies are in terms of code. It is written in legalese. It's written in lawyer language. We use the term today in legalese. It makes extensive use of the passive voice, which is very, very difficult, as many of us know. It's very difficult to deduce meaning from language, which is written largely in the passive voice and uses a series of modifiers and all the rest of it. It's very, very difficult to understand. One of the most important documents, I think, that's ever been written in American history. And I'd like to begin next week with a detailed analysis of Federalist Number 10. It'll probably take a couple of days. What I intend to do is post that document this weekend on our PRISM West Virginia website. It's prismwv.org, and I'd like to post that document on the website so that those of you listening can go to the prismwv.org website and look on and read for yourself Federalist Number 10, and then you can kind of read along with us as we talk about it next week. But even it's not even necessary to go to the PRISM West Virginia website. If you Google Federalist 10, you will get numerous documents on Google, numerous versions. They're not versions, they're actual copies of Federalist Number 10, but there are a number of them there. I would suggest that it's a good idea to print one for yourself. And look at it. Give it a look and see if it makes sense to you. And then as we go through it next week, you can compare what you've got with what we've got. And hopefully we can not only just talk about the document, but we can also share perceptions and ideas about the document. We encourage you to call 304-658-3333 is the number. It'll put you in directly into our studios and directly in contact. We'll have you on the air and we can discuss. You may, if you tuned in yesterday, you may have heard the conversation that Bob Kincaid and I had about Jefferson. I want to kind of return there in a moment and pick up where we left off yesterday about that. But you may have heard Bob Kincaid yesterday. Last week, you may have heard a call from Betsy in Texas, and we were talking specifically about education and about problems for teachers in the classrooms today in dealing with quality education. I might share with you a story. Yesterday morning, I here in southern West Virginia, I was teaching a class on world history, a freshman class, and we were looking specifically at selections from Thomas Hobbes's Leviathan, which is written in 1651 in Great Britain, another document written by John Locke, his second treatise on civil government, which was written in 1689. And I had given those two documents, not the entire documents, but just excerpts from them, to a freshman class in world history and asked them to do a comparative analysis of the two documents. And I returned those papers to the students yesterday morning. There were 36 papers submitted, and I had gone through them over the last week and made comments and I returned those documents to the students yesterday. And in class yesterday, we put the documents up on the overhead and we actually read them together, line by line, paragraph by paragraph, and we talked about those documents in class. And then, very honestly, I gave students who chose to the opportunity to redo the papers and resubmit them if they wanted to in order to improve their grade. But more important, this was a learning exercise in how to read critically and how to write analytically. That's really what I'm doing. So, I didn't want students to believe that, that they were being penalized grade-wise for not being able to do something which I hadn't had the opportunity to show them yet, but I wanted them to read these documents and to do the analysis for themselves, submit the papers, get my comments back, and then together we would look at those documents and go through them now that everybody has read the documents and has actually written on the documents. We could talk about them and discuss them and talk about the inferences and all the rest of them. What we're basically talking about here is the skill, and it is a skill, of reading critically and analytically and understanding, being able to compare and contrast and evaluate and rank and judge and all these other terms that our education system used in their standards. But the fact of the matter is our students have not had the opportunity to do this. And part of the reason is that their teachers have never had the opportunity to do this either. And one of the, it seems to me, one of the more telling comments we heard from Thomas Jefferson yesterday in his program for universal education was his suggestion or his thinking that the teachers in our schools would not come from the brightest students, but would rather come from bright students, but not necessarily the brightest students. I find that very, very telling. Because, of course, Jefferson's whole program was to develop an education system which established order at the elementary grades. And so you didn't need the sharpest pencil in the toolbox, so to speak, in order to do that. Because teachers would be operating from a carefully scripted curriculum. Remember, the idea was, as Jefferson said, we want an education during the first 3 years which is based principally on teaching history. And so, in a sense, what was happening here was a very scripted, carefully scripted curriculum for teachers. You didn't need your brightest people to do that. Rather, what you needed was well-trained teachers whose priority would be to communicate a set of objectives, learning objectives, to students. And understanding what Jefferson was talking about yesterday, we can go back and look at a couple of those statements in a moment, and considering what Jefferson was all about in his system for universal education, it's very, very obvious that what we're talking about here is training, not educating. If we were to make that distinction in using today's terms, we would be talking about an educational system for the masses that would focus more on training than on education, controlling what people believed rather than teaching them the skill to think, to question, to analyze, to disagree, to rank, to evaluate, to judge, all of these terms that we see thrown around, randomly thrown around. The fact of the matter is, and this was in the conversation that I had with Betsy last week and with Bob yesterday, very honestly, the bottom line is that we as a society have never really made the decision that we really wanted to risk really truly educating the masses. What we're talking about is a kind of education, a degree of education, which Jefferson believed, Benjamin Rush believed, we'll get to him today also, believed had to be reserved for the very brightest, for the potential future leaders of the society, not for the masses. And so, in a sense, if there's a crisis in our schools today, an educational crisis, it's because we as a nation have taken on the goal of educating everybody. But the dangers of that have caused us to educate people on different levels. And Jefferson, in the 1770s, was laying out an educational plan, a program, which was designed principally to tailor the level of education to the nature of the students being educated. In other words, there was no idea of giving people skills with the idea that through equality of opportunity, these people could rise to wherever their talents and their abilities might take them. On the contrary, this is the kind of education that was designed to fit people for the particular station in life that they were expected to believe. In other words, it was a level of education that was tailored, that was customized for where these people would be and what they would be doing for the rest of their lives. And as Jefferson said, it is a plan which he believes ought to focus on the comfort and the happiness of the students involved. And what that means is You do not challenge students. You do not ask students to do more than they are capable of doing. Rather, what you do is you basically provide a level of education that is tailored specifically to where these people are going to be in life and what they're going to do in life. We refer to it throughout the history of this country. We have referred to it as student-focused or student-based or skill or education. It is a level of education tailored to the particular needs of the particular students. I can remember it's very interesting. When I in my teaching career, I taught a course in American government. I remember this very clearly in the state of Virginia through the 70s and the 80s. And it was very interesting because we had two courses in American government. And at the time, I kind of saw it, but I didn't really understand fully what I was looking at. But we had two courses in American government that students, it was a community college system in Virginia, that students could register for. One of them was a transferable course in American government. It was the two-semester course that students would take if they planned to transfer to a four-year college or university and graduate with a bachelor's degree. And then we had this other one-semester scaled-down course in American government. I remember the number very well. It was Government 180. And it was American government for people who did not plan to go on to a four-year college or university and graduate with a bachelor's degree. It was an American government course that was tailored for people that were going to start with a two-year associate degree at the community college level. And so it was a lot less intense, a lot more superficial. It covered in one semester the same content that the two-semester course covered for transfer students to colleges and universities. The difference was in the depth with which the information, the content was covered, and the skills and the depth with which we were asking students to go in order to understand. In other words, we were giving students who were not going to graduate from college with four-year degrees a much more superficial, watered-down version of a survey course in American government that touched all the right bases, touched independence, touched the Declaration of Independence, touched the Constitution, touched the whole nature of the two-party system, touched the powers of Congress, the powers of the House of Representatives, the powers of the Senate, the role of the Supreme Court, the powers of the presidency, the role of the president in conducting both foreign policy and acting as commander-in-chief of the armed forces internally. Raise questions about the Bill of Rights and various other things. In other words, it touched all the appropriate bases for a survey course in American government. But it really didn't get into any depth because basically, and this is the point I'm trying to make, basically the goal was to expose students who were to be community college students who would graduate with a two-year associate degree rather than a four-year bachelor's degree. It was a course designed to expose these students to the key portion, the key parts, the key content in a course in American government. But it was a course that would never get into the kind of depth and raise the kinds of questions that a true understanding of the American political process would require. Of course, the fact of the matter is, even the two-semester course for transfer students didn't get into that much depth either. Later on, you know, there were advanced courses at the 300 and 400 level, junior and senior level of college, that touched on the nature of representative government and the powers of the presidency and the executive branch and the role of the Supreme Court in interpreting the Constitution and the rest of it. In other words, for people that were really going in that direction, we had much more intensive, in-depth courses. The point I'm trying to make is the state of Virginia had made a determination that two-year students who were clearly going to go to work in areas of electricity and plumbing and air conditioning and auto mechanics and all the rest of it, needed a course in American government as part of a curriculum because everybody expected anybody who went to college to know those kinds of things. But also the decision was made that we don't need the kind of depth and understanding there that a transfer student would need if he were going on to a four-year university, college or university. And so the courses were different. And one of the most interesting things, and I find this very encouraging because I still chuckle when I think about this, the textbook that we used in the 180 class for American government and the course that did not transfer, the textbook we used was a paperback, and the title of the book was Who Gets the Cookies? And I always found that to be an incredibly, incredibly powerful title for a textbook on American government, Who Gets the Cookies? Because in real terms, that's exactly what the American political process is all about, debating and arguing over who gets the cookies. That was the title of the book. It's kind of interesting because the four-year, just as a follow-up to that, as I think about it, I hadn't thought about this for years, very honestly. But the title of the book that we used in the two-semester transfer course in American government was James McGregor Burns in his book on American government. Has been reprinted 14 different times. I think it's in its 14th or 15th printing or something. It's been around for years and years and years. And it's interesting because Burns has, besides this textbook, Burns has written probably the classic study in America on the whole question of leadership. And for a graduate class that I am currently putting together, I'm basing a graduate class on leadership. That we're going to be offering online this summer for our teachers in our PRISM grant program. It's the last graduate course they're going to take. And the textbook that I'm pretty sure I'm going to use is the classic study on leadership by James McGregor Burns. I think it's James McGregor Burns. It may be Charles McGregor Burns. I can't remember. But anyway, I have these senior all the time as I get older, as I'm sure most of us do. Anyway, what I thought that we would do, so let me go back and kind of reiterate what I've mentioned here as we move towards the bottom of our first hour. We're 25% of the way through our program today. Beginning on Monday next week, I'd like to begin looking at the Federalist Papers, specifically looking at Madison's Federalist Number 10, which most people believe is the most important. I particularly agree with it as well. I've lived with that document for years. I continually find new things in it. I also have copies of Madison's analysis of the Confederation, which is called Vices of the American Political System, which is his view of what the problems are with the Confederation. And then, of course, Federalist Number 10 lays out exactly how the Constitution is going to fix those problems. So those two documents together, it seemed to me, become very, very important. When I was doing my research on for my doctorate on ratification of the Constitution, of course, I had Federalist Number 10. Everybody has Federalist Number 10. But in my research, I came across Madison's Vices of the American Political System, which I didn't even know existed. And it was a letter, it was a report, a letter that Madison put together and sent to those friends and colleagues, one of whom was Jefferson, whose opinion and whose voice he trusted very, very much. The interaction of letters between James Madison and Jefferson is incredibly deep. And it seems to me that what it suggests is that both of these guys, whose minds were incredibly insightful, they had incredible minds, both of them, and the fact that they exchanged so many letters, and the most interesting thing is, as you look through Madison's letters, that he'll have a number of letters that go a half a page, three-quarters of a page, a full page, a page and a half, to any number of people. He had letters like that to Washington and various other people, people throughout the states, John Adams and many others. But his letters to Jefferson tended to be 3 and 4 pages long because they were so in-depth. And what over the years, what I've begun to appreciate is that speaks to a tremendous respect that Madison had for Jefferson, trusting Jefferson to understand and react substantively to the ideas that he was throwing out. And the same thing was true for Jefferson. Jefferson, for example, when Madison was putting the Constitution together, was designing or developing the Virginia plan and putting it on paper, he was bouncing ideas off Jefferson, who was in France at the time. And Jefferson wasn't here for the Constitutional Convention. And when the document was finally released for public comment, Jefferson's major concern with it was the fact that it did not contain a Bill of Rights. And he and Madison went back and forth and argued why it should or it shouldn't require a Bill of Rights. And, of course, as we know, very late in the game during ratification, Madison is pretty much forced to concede the need for a Bill of Rights for amendments to be added to the Constitution, because the lack of a Bill of Rights was becoming a major political obstacle to ratification. When the Virginia ratifying convention was finally put together, when the elections were held and the candidates were chosen, the majority of those elected to the ratifying convention in Virginia were anti-federalists. In other words, the people of Virginia had elected a convention that was going to make the decision on the Constitution that was, at least going in, was opposed to, the majority of whom were opposed to ratification. So Madison had to do something. And one of the major issues of concern was the fact that it didn't have a Bill of Rights. And the anti-federalists were using the absence of a Bill of Rights as a major obstacle, as a major way to attack the Constitution. And so, for political reasons as much as anything else, Madison didn't really believe that a Bill of Rights was necessary. But on the other hand, he realized that politically it was necessary, because if you didn't have it, then ultimately there was a very, very strong likelihood that Virginia would not ratify the Constitution. So Madison committed to the idea when he ran for the convention that he would make the adoption of a Bill of Rights a priority business once the Constitution was ratified and once the new government went into effect, was implemented under President Washington in the spring of 1789. So anyway, we're going to look next week at The Vices of the Political System by James Madison, as well as at his Federalist Number 10. I've done this document numbers of times, and every time I do it, I enjoy it more because I respect it. I respect Madison. I respect the depth of his mind, and I find it exciting to play around with his language and to figure out what was in his mind when he said such and such the way he said it. It's beautiful. And, of course, the reality is that with the Vices of the Political System, you can speculate as to what Madison meant in Federalist Number 10, and then you can go back to what he said in the Vices of the Political System document, and there he lays out very clearly what he means by a particular phrase or a particular sentence that ends up in Federalist Number 10. I think you will find it extremely informative, and I think it's one of the, again, I've said this before, I think it's one of the most important political documents, along the Emancipation Proclamation and the Declaration of Independence and a number of other things. I think Federalist Number 10 is one of the most important political documents ever written in the history of this country, because the nature of the political system we live under is a system that was developed by James Madison. And in that document, in Federalist Number 10, he is explaining why the Constitution is organized the way it is, why it includes what it does, and why it doesn't include certain things. It's one of the most important documents, it seems to me, in American history. But let's take a moment. Let's go back and touch base a little bit, because more than anything else today, I'm kind of fired up a little bit over a conversation that we had with Bob Kincaid yesterday. Bob called during our last half hour. Those of you who were tuned in will remember. And he was especially taken with Jefferson's program for the general diffusion of knowledge, his system for universal education in the in Virginia in the 1770s. And I'm not surprised. And I, you know, Bob made the comment that, you know, he made a couple of very positive comments about the program yesterday. But most of his comments were about Jefferson, and well, they should be, because the program yesterday was about Jefferson. And let's face it, Jefferson was the man, and he's the one that laid out the program. It was his idea. It was his plan. It was his explanation as to why he believed that this plan was the one that we had to adopt, that Virginia had to adopt. And it becomes, the reason I mention it is not because of who Thomas Jefferson is and how important Jefferson was during the founding period, but also because as an educator, I've realized over the years that Jefferson's plan has pretty much been followed. It's pretty much the blueprint for the American system of education that we've had ever since then. We've come in a numbers of times throughout history. We come in and we tweak the system. We call it educational reform, and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. We're going to address this problem, and we're going to increase, we're going to improve test scores, and we're going to improve science and math skills, and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. But the fact of the matter is the system that we create is the system that Jefferson laid out in the 1770s. And it seems to me that if you're going to understand education at all, you've got to basically begin with Jefferson and with this document. And it seems to me you have to begin with the realization that Jefferson is a product of what history refers to, Western history refers to as the Enlightenment. The philosophical movement of the 16th and 17th and 18th centuries begins in the 16th century, but it's most prominent in the 17th and 18th century. Jefferson is a product of that. The thinking of people, philosophers like Immanuel Kant, the ideas and the thinking of the writing of Isaac Newton and Francis Bacon and the development of the scientific method, and all of these things that become part of this philosophical movement that has been the subject of so many books in Western history, which we refer to as the Enlightenment. And I thought what I might do today a little bit is kind of lay a little bit of background for this, and then try to indicate or show how Jefferson is a product of this, and how Enlightenment thinking is what drives his thinking. Because he's a product of this. I mean, he has read Locke, he has read Hobbes, he has read Harrington, he has read Gordon and Trenchard, he has read the criticisms of an absolute government in England, he has read Thomas Hobbes's defense of absolutism in 17th century England, he has read Locke's criticism of absolute government, the power of the monarch in, you know, written in 1689. He has read much of the Enlightenment literature that comes from this period called the Enlightenment. And the basic premise of the Enlightenment is, and I don't mean to make today's program, a lecture in the formal sense, but I really think that this is kind of important. The major thing about the Enlightenment, it seems to me, is best understood by contrasting it with the way people looked at the world during the so-called medieval period or the Middle Ages. In medieval Europe, before we had the creation of modern nations in Western Europe, before we had a Germany or an England or a France or a Spain or a Portugal or a Germany or an Italy or a Belgium or a Netherlands or whatever, we had Europe in the medieval period that was dominated by more local absolute power. The unifying factor in medieval Europe, since they were not the modern nation states to create the kind of political stability that we take for granted today, we know that there are nations, there are countries, there are citizens of that country, there are governments that they choose or elect or whatever. But in the medieval period, you didn't have that kind of political unit or political stability. On the contrary, Europe in the Middle Ages was very, you know, was very, very disorderly. The characteristic is one of political disorder. And most of the power was in the hands of local lords and local princes and local dukes. What I try to explain to students in order to explain this is think of the movies that you've seen or the literature that you've read about King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. And the idea is a local king or prince or whatever would have his own castle with his own army and his own moat. And ultimately, the
We now return to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution with your host, Dr. Bill O'Brien, after a brief interruption caused by Internet service provider failure.
This is Bill O'Brien, and we had kind of a breakdown in the Internet connection. It was not, this one was not technology related here. It was based on access to the Internet by our provider. So if I can go back and just pick up very quickly, because what I was talking about was just background information to where we are anyway. I was talking, if you remember, I was trying to suggest the degree to which Jefferson was a product of the Enlightenment. And in order to explain the Enlightenment, I was kind of going back and laying the background of medieval Europe. And the point I wanted to make, and I'll do this very quickly because it's not really the key point, the unity of medieval Europe was pretty much associated with the power and prestige and universality of the church. The fact that Christianity, this was prior to the Protestant Reformation, so Christianity was the Roman Catholic Church. And the head of the Roman Catholic Church was the Pope. And the teachings of Christianity, the teachings of the church, provided the unity that did not exist in Europe politically, because politically Europe was rather chaotic and rather unstable. but philosophically, because of the teachings of the church, the universality of the church created the unity that was medieval Europe. And so the only way to understand the Enlightenment is to understand the way it challenged the teachings of the medieval church. And very, very simply, or very, very briefly, let me explain that by suggesting that the church believed, the church preached, that the ultimate reason for life, the reason that we were on this earth, the reason that we were born, was in order to be saved. Very simply, what the church preached was that God so loved man that he sent his Son, his only begotten Son, to be crucified in order to provide the graces to basically provide salvation for all of us. And the church taught that the reason that we were here was to earn salvation, was to earn our way into heaven. And the way you did that was by following the dictates and the prescribed teachings of the church. The basic premise was that God so loved mankind that he created the church in order to assist man in his goal of being saved and living forever in eternity in the next life. And so the church had all of these sacraments with all these special graces, all these elements of Christianity that the church provided, which was guaranteed if you adhered to the teachings of the church, you would get to heaven. And what was included in that worldview of the church was an explanation as to how the world worked, and the implication was that man was not capable of understanding the mind of God. And that's why God gave us the church. The assumption was that man had no option except to believe what he was told. That the idea of asking questions or doing research or trying to understand the universe or the law that governed the universe or the rest of it, that man was to be frustrated forever if he tried to understand the universe that God created, because God's mind was so infinitely superior to man's that there was no way to understand. So the bottom line is that throughout the Middle Ages, the medieval period, man's priority was to believe, not understand. That's the point I wanted to make. The Enlightenment challenged that. The Enlightenment was based on the idea, and it goes all the way back to 1400s, to Copernicus and Galileo in the 1500s, challenging the church's view of the universe. The medieval church taught that the earth was at the center of the universe, and it made perfect sense in the worldview that the church basically defined. The idea was that Scripture tells us that God's greatest creature was man. It made perfect sense in the teaching of the church that if man was God's greatest creature, then it just made sense that man's greatest creature living on earth must mean that the earth is at the center of the universe, and that the sun and the stars and the moon and all the planets revolved around the earth. And of course, visibly, you could see that. You could look up and you could see the sun rise in the morning and set in the evening, and you'd see the moon come up in the, you know, at sundown and sink down in the horizon in, you know, as daylight emerged the next day. And so man's visible look, the way man saw the universe, seemed to affirm the teaching of the church, that the earth was at the center of the universe and everything revolved around it. And again, since God's greatest creature inhabited the earth, that made perfect sense to everybody. But beginning with Copernicus and then reinforced with Galileo, this worldview was challenged. And, of course, as we know, the reality was that the Earth is merely one of a number of planets which revolves around the sun. And so what Copernicus was suggesting is that the Earth is not at the center of the universe, the sun is. This basically shattered, challenged the total power of the Church to define reality. The Church reacted very, very defensively and very, very, very aggressively to these ideas. You may remember the very famous story of the Church forcing Galileo to recant and to deny that the things he had seen with his own telescope were true. They forced Galileo to basically deny the reality that his scientific observations had proven to him. Because once there is a crack in the worldview that the Church defined, then what's to stop people from raising other questions about other things that the Church taught? And, of course, the person that's going to drive the final nail in the Church's coffin, if you will, is going to be Martin Luther and his nailing of 95 theses on the Church door, because Luther is going to challenge many of the other teachings of the Church which Copernicus and Galileo had started. And so ultimately, once you open that door, there's no way to control it. The floodgates are open, and you basically have to live with what you have. So the result, philosophically, is the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment basically is based on the premise that man has a mind. It doesn't deny the existence of God. The Enlightenment accepts the idea of God the Creator. But it preaches that God, in his infinite wisdom, gave man a mind. And man's duty to his God is to use his mind in order to try to understand and appreciate the wonders of the world that God created. The image that the Enlightenment puts forth is the idea that God created the earth. It's kind of like the idea of a cuckoo clock, if you think of it. The idea is that God created the clock, and God pushed the pendulum and got the pendulum swinging. And the belief is, once that happened, once God did that, and once the pendulum started to swing, then God backed off and left it to man and said, this is what I've created, let's see what you can do with it. And so the belief is, that we call the Enlightenment, is that man has reason. John Locke made what I think is one of the most profound statements I've ever read. John Locke made the statement that reason is the voice of God within man. Man's ability to think logically, to reason, is, to John Locke, the voice of God within man himself. And the Enlightenment put a tremendous emphasis on man's ability to reason and to understand and to think and to evaluate and to learn and to know and to learn more. What the Enlightenment benefits from is the idea that, you know, beginning with Copernicus, but then going on with other scientific discoveries, what we begin to realize, what Enlightenment thinkers begin to realize, is that there are laws of nature. There are laws governing the universe. It's not an accident that the planets don't crash into each other. It's not an accident that the moon doesn't fall out of the sky and hit the earth. It's not an accident that the sun doesn't fall. It's not an accident that the earth doesn't go careening into the sun. Because what more and more investigation begins to reveal is that there are laws governing the universe. And to the Enlightenment thinkers, this doesn't challenge the existence of God. This enhances the existence of God. In other words, the more man learns about the universe that God created, the more appreciation for the wonder and the awesome power of God they develop. But what they also begin to do is emphasize the power of man, the creative, investigative power of man. Basically, the idea being that God created everything in the universe for man's use. The idea being that God issued a challenge. God created the universe and all that was in it. He gave man the mind, and that he basically left it to man to see what he could do with what God created. The Enlightenment thinkers did not believe that God was a participant in man's day-to-day lives. Enlightenment thinkers did not believe that God performed miracles. They did not believe that God interfered in the day-to-day lives of people. They did not believe, for example, that making the sign of the cross before you go up at home plate is going to help you hit a home run, as we see today. The point is, they did not believe that God was an active participant and interfered in man's day-to-day life. The idea is, man created the universe, God created the universe, he gave man a mind, and it was up to man to see with what he could do, what he could accomplish with what God gave him. And that's what the Enlightenment people thought. So they began to think and put an emphasis on reason. God had reason. God had common sense. So, for example, the Thomas Hobbeses and the John Lockes and the Harringtons and the other thinkers and philosophers of this period that we call the Enlightenment began to speculate, began to apply reason and say, you know, basically, imagine yourself. I did this with students yesterday, so I can't help but I have to repeat it this way because this is the way I put it yesterday. Imagine yourself in a private room. There's no TV, no computers, no radio, no sound, just you and a cold beer. And you're sitting there and you're thinking about the nature of government. Where did it come from? Why would man create government in the first place? What would man's life have been like before there was an organized society, before there was government? And I'm kind of giving you a breakdown here of the ideas of John Locke and Thomas Hobbes. The thinking is that let's imagine, if we can, close your eyes and imagine what life would be like prior to the creation of government or the existence of laws or the existence of an organized society or everything else. Let's pretend that man exists in what we can call, for lack of a better term, a state of nature. Let's imagine a time when man is totally free to do whatever he wants. What would the state of nature be like? Thomas Hobbes is writing his Leviathan in the 1640s. He publishes it in 1651. In 1649, 2 years before Hobbes publishes the Leviathan, Charles I, King of England, is beheaded. And for the next 11 years, England is under the control of Parliament, the forces of Parliament under the leadership of Oliver Cromwell. I'm dating myself a little bit because I can't help saying, played in the movies by George C. Scott. And so, up until 1649, England had a king, an absolute monarch. But beginning in 1649, with the beheading of the king, England goes through a period of 11 years in which they do not have the king. And history books refer to this as the interregnum, the between monarchs, or between royal regimes, because there was no king. And then in 1660, the king is restored in the person of Charles II in what is called, in history books, the Restoration, which is the restoration of the crown. And in 1651, 2 years after the execution of Charles I, Thomas Hobbes publishes his Leviathan, which is his defense of the need for an absolute government, a monarchy. And Hobbes is a product of the Enlightenment. He has gone through, he has sat in his study with no computers and no TVs and no radios, just him and a cold beer. And he has speculated about the state of nature and what it would be like if men were totally free to do whatever they wanted to do. And those of you listening who are familiar with Hobbes may remember that Hobbes said that the state of nature would be a perpetual state of warfare where every man would be at war with every other man. It would be insecure, it would be unstable, it would be dangerous, there would be no progress, there would be no peace, there would be no careers, nobody would be free because everybody was spending their every waking moment defending themselves or trying to take from somebody else and protect what you had so that people wouldn't take from you. In other words, Hobbes's definition of the state of nature is one of perpetual warfare. The reason for that, Hobbes believed, is because human nature is basically so evil. Hobbes was a Christian. He was familiar with Scripture, the whole idea of original sin. And Hobbes bought into the idea that as a result of original sin, man's rejection of the Redeemer, the Jews' rejection of the Redeemer, that man was forever stained with original sin. What that meant was that human nature was evil. Man's inclination was always to do what's wrong, not what is right. Man cannot do good unless he's forced to do good. So to Hobbes, you had to have a government whose power was absolute, because human nature was so bad. The way Hobbes writes in the Leviathan is that men in the state of nature still had reason, and reason told them that this was no way for man to live, that there had to be a better way. And man's reason led them to believe that what they had to do was create an absolute government, an all-powerful government, whose power was so awesome because every member of society, every member of the community, had to surrender his power and his freedom to the sovereign. In other words, the sovereign's power was absolute because the sovereign possessed the sum total of all the powers of all the people in that particular society. The idea being that the sovereign would exercise total power because he got his power from the people. So this is consent of the governed. It's popular government, where people voluntarily concede all of their power to the sovereign. And the sovereign rules absolutely and is able to give the people what the people are not able to give themselves because they cannot overcome their evil human nature. Now, you may say to yourself, How come the sovereign isn't a victim of the same evil human nature that the people are? That obviously is a contradiction in Hobbes. But Hobbes believes that people's freedom, people's safety, people's security, people's ability to create, their ability to enjoy life on a day-to-day basis, their ability to be free, all of it is contingent on the power of government. Because government's power is so absolute, man's freedom is guaranteed. So if you use the equations that mathematicians use all the time, man's freedom is a function of government power. The idea is that, because students raise this question all the time, what if you disagree with the sovereign? The assumption, the belief is, in Hobbes, you really can't. Because theoretically, the sovereign is ruling in a way that you would rule if you could. So in other words, everybody's will is contained in this one will. In the 18th century in France, Rousseau used the term the general will, and he talked about the fact that there is a best, that if you were to sound out every citizen, every person in society, in the Commonwealth, and you were to pull all the points of view together, Rousseau argued that there would be a general will, a best thing that everybody would realize, everybody's reason would tell him would be the right thing to do. And that's what government's responsibility was, is to rule according to what Rousseau defined as the general will. Hobbes believed that the power of government needed to be absolute. You could not get opinions from the people. You could not allow the citizens to participate in decision-making because they were so corrupt and so evil that their number one priority would always be themselves rather than other people. They would never be willing to put the public interest ahead of their own self-interest. The only person that can do this is the sovereign, because the sovereign's power is the sum total of everybody else's power. So again, Hobbes is writing in defense of absolute government. 30 years later, in 1689, there is a revolution. In 1688, there is a revolution. The king is forced to flee. James II is forced to flee England, and Parliament assumes power in England in what is called the Glorious Revolution in the history books. Now you got to realize that the Parliament didn't sit there together and say, let's call what we just did the Glorious Revolution. The reason historians refer to it as the Glorious Revolution, because it's the first appearance of popular representative government in the world of modern nations in the context of parliamentary supremacy over the king. In other words, one Parliament is successful in 1688 in driving the king from England, and then inviting William of Orange and his wife Mary and offering them the crown in 1689, the king is no longer absolute in England. Parliamentary supremacy has been achieved. And this is called the Glorious Revolution in the history books. And John Locke, in his Essays on Civil Government, Enlightenment thinker, basically puts together his rationale, his explanation, according to common sense and reason, as his defense of limited government, why government had to be limited and should not be absolute. And if you read John Locke, he begins exactly what Hobbes does. Let's pretend that we're in our studio, in our little room, with no windows, no TV, no computers, no radio, no noise, no music, just you and a cold beer. And you sit there and imagine what the state of nature would be like. And Locke says the state of nature would not be all that bad. And the reason is because Locke says man has reason. Man has common sense. And man's reason would tell him that he could expect nothing other than to have others do to him what he did to them. In other words, it's the golden rule. Locke believed that the golden rule would dominate the state of nature because man's reason would be the law of nature. In other words, and if the law of nature is reason, then Locke believes that everybody would know it. And everybody would understand what the rules are. And everybody would know that if they violated the laws of nature, then they could probably expect that people would turn around and violate it against them. And so Locke's position is that man's common sense and his reason would tell him that if I treat people this way, they'll treat me the same way reciprocally. And Locke talked about the fact that man was free. He had the right to protect his property. Everybody was free to own and work property. But Locke also made the point that when you had as much property as you needed, not as much as you could get, but as much as you needed, then you had to turn your efforts to help your fellow man. In other words, once you had what you needed, then you had a responsibility to your neighbors to help them get what they needed. In other words, despite what conservatives tell us today about Locke and Locke's emphasis on life, liberty, and property, and the whole idea of free enterprise and competition and the rules of the market and all of these things that we pick up from Adam Smith, who also is an enlightened thinker, Locke argues, contrary to what these people tell us, that there is a community emphasis in Locke, which they choose not to mention. Locke argues that man has a responsibility to look to the welfare of his fellow man. That man lives in a community, and as such, there are limitations to his own freedom. There is limitations to what he has a right to. He has a right to have his property protected and not interfered with other people, but he does not have the right to more property than he can use. And so there is a balance in Locke, that those who choose to use him to justify a particular political agenda and an economic agenda today tend to misinform us about. There is a tendency among conservatives to deny that John Locke had any concern or emphasis with people other than their own freedom, that all they talk about is man's freedom. They don't talk about the responsibilities of freedom that Locke talks about. So Locke's position is that the state of nature is not too bad because reason dominates it. The law of nature defines what man can and can't do, and that law of nature is basically reason. And reason, as I mentioned earlier, Locke says, is the voice of God within man himself. But Locke points out that it stands to reason that occasionally there would be an offender. There would be somebody who violated the law of nature. There would be somebody who broke the law. And the state of nature, Locke says, was very inconvenient because people were required to enforce the laws of nature themselves because there was no government. There was no police force. There was no army. There were no enforcers. People had to be their own enforcers. Locke tells us that at some point in time, man's reason would tell him and say, God, there's got to be a better way than this. There's got to be a way. What if we were to appoint a defender, if we were to create a government, but we would carefully limit the... We would create a government whose authority was carefully defined, and we would force government to agree to that deal, to that contract. In other words, government would be the product of a contract between itself and the people that created it. Government's power would come from the consent of the governed. People would have to voluntarily agree to abide by the rules that government made. But government, on the other hand, would be required to live within the terms of the contract which created it. And its contract would clearly specify that its responsibilities were to protect life, preserve freedom, and protect man's property from violation or invasion of other from other people who would infringe upon their rights, their liberty, and their property. And so Locke's contract is different than Hobbes's. Whereas Hobbes argued that man had to create an all-powerful sovereign because human nature was so bad, and that was the only way to create order, Locke believed that human nature was not all that bad because reason dominated it, and man could create government to enforce his will and protect his natural rights to life, liberty, and property, and basically force government to enter into a contract to do this. And Locke also argued that if ever a time came when government broke that contract, when government tried to assume more power than the people had originally been willing to give it, then the people had not only a right, but they had a responsibility to terminate that government and to create a new government that would abide by the terms of the social contract. Now, if you are seeing similarities between this and Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, that's because Jefferson was a product of the Enlightenment. Jefferson believed completely the logic of this. Proof is in Jefferson. Think about it. I'm operating on memory here. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Think about that. What Jefferson is saying in the Declaration at the very beginning is, what I'm going to say is truth. And it's truth that everybody knows, that all thinking people know. In other words, what he's saying is, this is the reality of the Enlightenment that all thinking people know and understand. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that at the beginning everybody's the same, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are the rights to life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. And you can read the debates in the Continental Congress, the committee of five that drafted the Declaration. And John Adams especially makes the point to Jefferson, you cannot come out with a document saying that this war of independence from the mother country is designed to protect property, because that's going to make it look like this is a war to protect the wealthy. And so Jefferson's change from John Locke, from property to pursuit of happiness, and of course some people will facetiously say that in a free enterprise society like ours, the pursuit of happiness is property, wealth, money, position, influence, etc. So Jefferson said, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And in order to preserve these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their power from the consent of the governed. This is Jefferson. Straight lock. Straight enlightenment thinking and reasoning and rationale. Okay, let's look, let's think about that. And of course, Jefferson goes on in the preamble to the Declaration to basically point out that if government violates the contract, if government exceeds its powers that the people have been willing to give it, then the people have not only the right, they have a responsibility to overthrow that government and to create a new government that basically will live within the confines of the social contract. And then, without, you know, just to bring this to a logical conclusion, and then, as you remember, Jefferson goes in and begins to list violation after violation that the King of England has inflicted upon the colonies. In other words, what he's doing is setting out and saying, basically, the king has done this, he's done that, he's violated this, he's violated our rights to party, he's violated our rights to trial by jury, he's violated our rights as free people, he's abolished our colonial governments, he's ignored our petitions, he's ignored our pleas, he's done this, he's done that. In other words, what Jefferson is doing is making the case that all the colonies are doing is fulfilling the self-evident truths as defined by Enlightenment thinkers for more than 100 years, that the people have a responsibility. And Jefferson says, if you remember, we have petitioned, we have begged, we have pleaded, we have prostrated ourselves. We have done everything that anybody could ever ask us to do in order to avoid the position that we are in right now. But now, Jefferson says, we have no choice. We have no option left. And so from Jefferson's position in the Declaration, independence is not something that the colonies went after aggressively. Independence was something that English stupidity forced upon them. In other words, the real conservatives in this are the colonists. The aggressors, the radicals, are in England, are across the ocean. And this is the case that Jefferson presents to the nation and to the world. It's classic Enlightenment. It's a classic Enlightenment product. Okay, let's take that, and now let's go to where we were yesterday with Jefferson's ideas on education. Obviously, Jefferson's viewpoint, his position, his philosophy doesn't change. The Declaration of Independence is 1776. His program for the draft of the legislation for the general diffusion of knowledge in Virginia is in 1779. So his whole philosophy didn't change in 3 years. So the assumption is that there ought to be all sorts of Enlightenment thinking and Enlightenment ideas in his position on public education. What you do, Jefferson says, and I'm rehashing what we did yesterday, what you do is you divide the state of Virginia into sections, into regions, into districts called hundreds, 20 of them. And each one has a school. And what you do is you require all children to go to school, rich and poor, everybody. Not women, not blacks, boys. But boys, not just boys from families with money who could afford to send their kids to private school. No, you want all boys to go to school with everybody else. And the assumption being that if you do that and you create a competitive environment then it is logical to assume, reason again, that talent will rise to the top like cream. In fact, in another place, Jefferson makes the point when he talks about finding the boy of best genius and being raked from the rubbish annually and educated at public expense. Jefferson uses the phrase, these periodic skimmings of the cream of ability. That's it. I mean, that just makes perfect sense. Jefferson's saying that by going in every year and skimming the cream of ability, you find the boy of best genius in every competitive situation, and you pull that child out and you continue him along the path toward a high-quality education. What you are doing is you are operating on the assumption that all talent and all ability does not necessarily reside within the upper classes. What you were saying is there's probably talent and ability amongst the poor as well, and it's society's job to find it. Now, if you are if you're conspiratorial, I've heard people say this, if you are, one of those people that subscribe to conspiracy theories, you could argue that what Jefferson is doing here is extracting talent and leadership ability from the lower classes. In other words, you are ensuring order amongst the masses by regularly extracting its brightest people so that they end up being leaderless. That you are appropriating the talent and the ability and the creativity and the insight. You're making sure that the poor, that the masses, do not develop their own caliber or their own quality leadership because you're taking that talent away on a regular basis. But on the other hand, I mean, to be positive about that, what you're doing is you're basically saying not all talent and ability is necessarily in the upper classes, so therefore, by these periodic skimmings of the cream of ability, we are taking the best from the bottom and we're making sure that society has access to the best talent that exists among us, whether it be from the wealthy or whether it be from the poor, whose parents are too poor to afford education for themselves. And what you do is you use this system of merit to find the boy of best genius, and you basically continually put that child in a competitive situation until you reach the epitome, which is to send them to, at that time, the best, which was the College of William and Mary. And you may remember that later on, after he leaves the presidency, Jefferson is instrumental in creating the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. He wants to create the flagship institution for his state. And of course, what he's talking about here is educating the best people in Greek, Latin, geography, and the higher branches of arithmetic. We're not going to waste our time teaching subjects like this to people who can't appreciate it or don't know. And Jefferson's argument would be, I think if we had the opportunity to engage him in a question and answer, Jefferson would probably say it would be cruel, it would be unfair, it would be to deny happiness to people to inflict upon them a kind of education that they neither needed nor could handle. So what you have done with this preliminary system of 3 years of guaranteed education is you have created a competitive opportunity so that cream will rise to the top. And then you are tailoring your education in such a way that you don't create stress. You basically tailor education to the needs and abilities of the students that you are teaching. Where this becomes a problem for me and a problem for us in today's education system is that if you are doing this, you are almost guaranteeing that these people who are defined as rubbish will never become or only with extreme difficulty can these people make it in this society. In other words, what you are doing is you are labeling them in such a way that their opportunities for success in the future are dealt a severe blow. How does a student overcome being lumped amongst the rubbish? Think about this. Think about what we know happens in our education system today. Think about the student who begins school in the early grades and learns very quickly how to become a good student in this system. I'm being contemporary here. This is a passion of mine, so I can't resist this. Think about the student in our education system today. How do you avoid failure? The way you avoid failure is you make sure that you're never wrong. And the way you make sure that you're never wrong is that you never risk being wrong. The teacher offers a reward system which says the student that gets the highest grade on the spelling test today will have the honor of cleaning the blackboards at the end of the day today. That becomes a reward that's worth going after. So we are creating a system in which people are rewarded for performance with trinkets, with M&Ms, so to speak. But the point is that you do not engage, you do not volunteer, you do not risk being wrong, because once you are labeled as somebody who makes mistakes, then you are limiting your ability to be successful and to move on. I'm thinking when I taught public school, and admittedly it was a number of years ago, but I can remember in so-called free periods when you'd go to the teacher's lounge when you had a free period to eat your lunch or have coffee and a snack or whatever, and teachers would be there on their breaks, and they would be talking about students. I mean, that's all they had in common, of course, was students. So one teacher, and I was a beginning teacher, and I would sit there and I would listen to these conversations, and I would hear this teacher say, I understand that you have Mary Smith in your 10 o'clock class. And the other teacher would say, yes, I do. And the teacher would say, what do you think of Mary Smith? She says, well, she's been so hard, probably do it if you turn your back on her or something like that, any comment like that. And suddenly what you have done is you have labeled a student. You have blackballed a student effectively. You have planted in the minds of future teachers an image of which students can be trusted, which students can perform, which students can't perform. So the reality is that students basically establish a reputation as they go through this mill, through this system of grade 1, grade 2, grade 3, grade 4, and they become known. They become stereotyped. And the reality is, by the time students get into middle school, into the 7th, 8th, and 9th grades, they know how the game is played. They know how to avoid this. And so ultimately, by that time, they're still on track to be successful, which meant that they've learned to keep their mouth shut. They've learned to cultivate teachers in order they've learned to feign interest, to pretend that they care. all the strategy. In other words, our students become professional students. They know how the game is played. They know how the rewards are disseminated. They know what you should do in order to be successful, and they know what you better not do if you don't want to be successful. And then on the other hand, you have those kids who don't know, who don't learn how the game is played, who make mistakes, who cause problems, who are disciplined, who establish a reputation, who are put into special classes. This student can't learn with everybody else. He or she needs to be in a special class. You need to tailor the information. You can only expect this much performance out of the students, etc. What you are doing is you are typing students in such a way that it becomes almost impossible for them to break out of the stereotype that the system itself has created for them. So in a sense, you've done exactly the same thing that Jefferson talks about. You basically have relegated the majority of young people to the rubbish heap in your search for the boy of best genius. And that is the way. We've had reforms. We've had a number of things throughout the years that we have done. But the fact of the matter is we really have never changed the system. We have never really so changed the system that we have decided everybody in our society has the opportunity to contribute. Everybody has a skill. Everybody has a talent. Everybody has something they can do better than what other people, most people can do. And what we need to do in this system of education is we need to find those talents and find those skills and cultivate them. More than that, we need to make sure that every student learns what he or she is going to need to know in order to be successful in this society. We have never been willing to subject our education system to the objective of educating everybody. Instead, we continue to search for the boy of best genius. And in the process, we're effectively rejecting the contributions of 70 or 75% of our young people. We can't continue to do this. Talk to counselors in our public schools. Find out who the students are that they actively counsel. And what you find out is that counselors will spend the bulk of their time working with and talking to students who have the potential to get into the best colleges and universities. These are the ones that get the best ACT scores or the best SAT scores. These are the ones that are going to win the scholarships and the fellowships and the rewards and the accolades. These are the ones that are going to become salutatorians and the brightest student in their class or the second brightest student in their class or whatever. And they're the ones that get the bulk of the time. And then, of course, at the other end of the spectrum, you have the 10 to 15% who are your rebels. These are the people that never learned the rules. These are the people that were penalized and punished from the very beginning, and finally they just give up. And then in the middle, you have these students who continue to struggle and continue to try, but they really aren't sure why they never seem to make it. Why they never seem to. It seems like the example that I use all the time, it seems like somebody else always has the right answer and it's never me. The teacher's going to say, didn't I say the other day in lecture, da 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 da, or did you read chapter 7? In chapter 7, on page so and so, it says such and such. In other words, the right answer is always somewhere. It's in the book, it's at the end of the chapter, it's in my lectures, it's in the library, it's on Google, it's somewhere, but I never have it. And so, in a sense, what we are doing is we are putting the emphasis on the content we teach. But what we're really teaching is order, obedience, predictability, dependability, and the skills the behavioral attributes that people need in order to fulfill the role. So in a sense, we are basically saying, in the way we approach education, that truth is equated with the content we teach. In other words, the information that we give to students is the education. The reality is, the education is not in the content at all. The education is in the students' abilities and willingness to engage that content. When I teach history, what I say about the founding fathers, or what I say about the Declaration of Independence, is not the education. It's what happens to the student who is willing to engage that information, who's willing to process it, think about it, criticize it, analyze it, grasp it, compare it, contrast it, try to understand it. The changes that happen within the student as the result of engaging this information, that's the education. So in a sense, truth is not in the content we present to students. Truth is within the students themselves. The ability to discover truth already exists within the students. Our job as teachers is to bring it out, is to find the skills, hone the skills, develop the skills, identify the skills, point out places where students have particular talents and particular abilities, and hone and cultivate those students so that we turn out students who leave our education system with a sense of optimism and a sense of excitement and a sense of enthusiasm, rather than walk out of our education system with their heads down and their education in a bunch of notebooks that they have tucked under their arm. The education is not in those notebooks. The education is what has happened to the student as a result of engaging the information that is in those notebooks. And we have never been willing in our society to fully engage education in that context. If I can, we've got about 15 minutes left in today, actually about 10 minutes left in today's program. I want to end it with a quotation. I'm certain that many of you have heard about, maybe even read, Plato's famous Allegory of the Cave from his Republic. If you've read Plato's Republic, in Book 7, it ends with the very famous Allegory of the Cave. And this is, where Plato says in the dialogue with Glaucon, imagine these people chained to a cave, looking at the back wall, they can't turn around, and there's fires behind them, and they're casting shadows on the wall. And these people have spent their whole lives looking at that wall. And to them, the shadows of reality are reality. And then Plato says, imagine that one of them was freed and could turn around and could look at the light and suddenly realize that everything that he's been looking at is not reality, but merely a shadow of reality. And Plato says, imagine even further that this student, that you take this person, this freed person, you take him out of the cave and out into the sunlight. And this student, this person would be going from darkness into light. And we know that when we do that, our eyes, we can't see, we can't focus, we tend to look down, we shield our eyes because our eyes hurt because of the brightness of the light when we come out of the darkness. But Plato says that gradually our eyes would adjust and we would be able to raise our heads and look up and look around and we would see trees and clouds and the blue sky and mountains and rivers and flowers. We would begin to see the world as he doesn't say as God created it, but the world as God created it. And then he would look up and he would see the sun, and he would realize that the light and the heat and everything that is good is coming from that sun. And then Plato says, imagine then this person returning to the cave, going back with his comrades who are still chained looking at those shadows. Imagine the challenge of trying to bring truth to those people. In other words, imagine the challenge of trying to explain to those people that everything that they believe is real is not. Everything that they see and believe is reality is merely the shadow of reality. But now you have the truth, and you're going to bring it to them. And Plato basically puts the question to Glaucon and said, what would happen? What would you do? And Glaucon says, these people would kill him because everything they believed, everything that makes their life meaningful, he would be destroying. He would be shattering. He would be saying that nothing that was real to you was really real. And that's the story that Plato proposes in his allegory of the cave. And at the very end, Plato ends with this line. And he's talking about the education of the people that go back into the cave. These are your teachers. Think of the challenge. And Plato says this, but then, if I am right, certain professors of education must be wrong when they say that they can put knowledge into the soul which was not there before, like sight into blind eyes. Whereas our argument shows that the power and the capacity of learning exists in the soul already. And that just as the eye was unable to turn from darkness to light without the whole body, so too the instrument of knowledge can only by the movement of the whole soul be turned from the world of becoming into that of being, and learn by degrees to endure the sight of being, and of the brightest and best of being, or in other words, of the good. Plato basically says that the kind of education he's talking about is not the kind of education that is involved in putting knowledge into the soul which was not there before. Because Plato says the power and capacity of learning exists in the soul already. The job of the teacher is to bring it out, is to find what there is within the individual child and cultivate it and develop it and honor it and respect it, develop it and value it so that the youngster will too. What I am suggesting, and what I ask you to think about, is the extent to which the education system, which we know and we pay for and we're comfortable with because we've all been through it, whether the system of education that we know is one which assumes that the ability to learn is already within the individual, exists within the soul, and the education we offer is designed to bring it out, or whether we are assuming that education is the content that we try to bring in to the soul from the outside. I would suggest to you that we're talking about two kinds of education here. The use of content to control behavior, to define and control and predict behavior, is the education that Jefferson defines for the masses. But on the other hand, there's another kind of education, the kind of education that people who go to Princeton and Harvard and Yale and Dartmouth and the rest of them get. They don't get education this way. Basically, what Plato was about is educating his guardians, educating the leaders, what he called in his republic, the philosopher kings, the brightest people. These were the people who left the cave. These are, to Plato, these are the people that know, that can know and handle truth. And basically what Plato's challenge is, we have to find a way to require our leaders to go back into the cave and educate the rest. I would suggest to you that those are the two approaches to education. I would also suggest to you that real educational reform is based upon our ability to instill Plato's approach to education throughout our education system. The first step is to recognize that the content we teach is not the education. It's what happens to the student as a result of receiving that content, of being exposed to that content that is. And I would share with you the fact that you can look up anything on Google. There is no reason in the world for us to continue to believe that presenting content through lecture or textbooks or anything else is education. Every student has access to the internet. Every student can go to Google and find out anything he wants to know. The challenge is to find a way to get students to want to know. It's one thing to be able to look up anything you need to know on Google. It's another thing to want to know anything. I would suggest to you that the vast majority of the students that we are graduating from our education systems, or the students who are quitting, who are dropping out, who are leaving school in the beginning because they don't see anything in it for them, these basically are the people for whom the education system is not working. I would argue it's because they've never really been exposed to it. It's difficult, it's rigorous, it's challenging, but it is so exciting. There is absolutely nothing more exciting in the world than learning things that you didn't know before. And I would suggest to you that that is the major difference in the systems of education. Putting Jefferson back into the context within which he's writing, you can begin to understand when he talks about the education, the kind of education that the masses must have in order for popular Republican government to work, from his perspective, it makes sense because that's the society he came from. However, we as a nation have taken on the responsibility of educating everybody. In order to do that, we have got to rethink the way we define education. My clock shows that we're about 3 minutes from the top of the hour, and what that means is it's time for us to wrap up here and give Bob Kincaid an opportunity to take over and begin to get his equipment ready for his program this evening. So with that, I'm going to sign off and bid you all a very, very, first of all, a very sincere thank you for being with us today. I hope that you found it rewarding and useful. I hope that you will pick up the phone and give us a call and we can talk about some of these things, because I think they're worth talking about. I really do. I haven't been doing this at all. And I look forward for us to get back together again tomorrow, and we will continue this. Tomorrow will be our last program this week. It'll be Wednesday. And then when we come back next week, we'll begin to look at the Federalist Papers specifically. This is Bill O'Brien. Thank you so much for being with us today. Bidding you a safe, enjoyable evening, and we'll get back together again tomorrow. Thank you.
America! I beg you! Crap! Germany! UK! America! Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Here we are. It's Tuesday. Ordinarily, this would be Titanic Tuesday, and I guess it sort of is. But I would hope in the national memory and for a very long time that this day will be a day of remembered shame, abiding shame, deep shame, merciless shame. For this is, of course, the 19th day of March, this particular year, 2013, marks the 10th anniversary of quite possibly, in the history of a long, long string of nasty misdeeds on the part of this country, that this day will shine is not the right word. That this day will live, as FDR said, in infamy. Not for something someone did to us, but for something we did to an innocent country, to ourselves, and to the world. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home online where you can find the button with which to stream live. It just says listen live, and it's that easy. Click it and go. You can find us on a number of platforms besides our own homepage. There are smartphone apps for TuneIn Radio and for Stitcher Internet Radio. There are online platforms like Dar.fm and Streama.com. We're listed in your Roku devices. It might take a little looking. The podcast address is under the subdomain for this program at WhiteRoseSociety.org, and you can also get the podcasts at iTunes. The Horn is a listener-supported enterprise. Thank you very much to, and again, I reiterate, when you contribute, if it's okay to use your name, let me know so that I can tell people at least a first name for who is helping keep all of this going. But many, many thanks go out for what I thought was going to wind up being a very slow fundraising night. We try to raise $150 in any given evening. And we actually made that goal last night toward the end. And we are, all of us who have participated in this are deeply thankful for that. So instead of being in a $300 hole this evening, we start out just trying to raise our usual $150 for any given show. And that's a lot easier to talk about than raising $300 or $450. So thank you very much. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. The snail mail address is as follows. The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB, that stands for Personal Mail Box, 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, W-V, 25801. If contributing by snail mail, please don't make anything payable to Bob Kincaid. Head-on communications is probably the best way to put it on the pay-to line. Makes life a lot easier for boss man Wayne when he opens up the mailbox and there's not an echo there and there's actually mail, and he is able to send it on to the Horn Bank account, and we can pay more bills. Paid some bills last night, mercifully. Thank you very much. By the way, another magnificent couple of hours of broadcasting, absent some technical difficulties that we are still trying to work out in trying to get Dr. Bill's signal more consistent. Going to be working on that tomorrow. But another magnificent 2 hours of consideration of the origins of this nation from Dr. Bill. From one day to the next, I don't know of anybody else out there doing full availability, interactive, master's degree and upward level American history on the terrestrial radio or on the interweb tubes. So do avail yourselves of that. Ben Birch tells me he is working on putting up a new archive for Dr. Bill with a complete podcast feed and everything. So by all means, avail yourself of that when it's up. In the meantime, we've got a whole bunch of people subscribed to the Horn's Dropbox account, which is also where we put sound files for Ben to grab and for you to grab in the event that you have a hard time getting, you know, one of these, any individual show, if there's a problem with the upload or the recording on Ben's side goes bad. It's always there in the Dropbox. And I wanted to, just a note about the Dropbox. When you download a program from it, please do not delete the file, because that means nobody else can get it and I have to re-upload it. So just download it, but it's when it says, do you want to delete, say, no, really, I don't. Okay? We've had a really good response to the Dropbox, and if you want in on it and you send me an email, I will add you with an invitation to the Horn Dropbox file. And I can report to you, this coming from Jack in Shreveport, who had asked to be included in that. Just sent along some Dropbox feedback. He said, I wanted to let you know what happened with the Dropbox procedure after I emailed you asking for an invite, just in case anybody else might ask, and to let you know what happens on the other end, because I really don't know. I received an email from Dropbox within a minute or two, plus or minus, of when you emailed me that you'd sent it. It had a link to click on. Clicking on the link will launch your browser. It wants cookies to be enabled. You do not have to sign up for anything. I just clicked on the file names links that I wanted, and it gives you a button to download each individually. You can sync all at once, but I didn't try that. Dr. Bill's radio show files were from 50 to 60 megabytes each and downloaded quickly. So everything worked great, and I was pleased not to have to sign up for anything. No curveballs were thrown at me. And that's always a bonus. So thanks for updating us on that end of the process, Jack. So if you want to be in the Dropbox, shoot me a note, and if I've missed anyone, if you've seen anyone, because I got a bunch, and I tried to respond to all of them, but they all sort of come into the same place, bobkincaid@gmail.com, let me know, and I will include you in the Horn Dropbox as well. To be fair, if you don't have Dropbox and you do sign up for it, it expands our ability on this end to put more stuff up there. So that means that the more capacity we have, the more stuff we can put on it and leave there for longer periods of time. So there, that's that. Now, tonight, program notes. One, Thursday night, I'm really looking forward to this because I know a lot of you people read him and follow him. Thursday night, we will have Dave Zirin on the program to discuss the Steubenville case that we went over in some detail last night, but focused primarily on the media response to the verdict, as opposed, which, oh, my God, that's a response. That's professional media. We focused more on that, but on Thursday evening, in a conversation with Dave Zirin, we will talk at greater length about the culture that leads to something like a Steubenville, or the culture that led, for instance, to the whole Jerry Sandusky debacle. So that's this Thursday evening, and I hope you'll join in. Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation, author, and his homepage is edgeofsports.com. Second program note, I'm headed to D.C. You may recall that it's been well over a month since anyone's been to D.C. to work on the ACHE Act, ACHEACT.org, to learn more. Everything you need to know about the ACHE Act is at ACHEACT.org, as well as the means for, by which you can take action to ask your member of Congress or your senators, because we need it introduced in the Senate as well, to get behind this effort to end the horrors of mountaintop removal in Appalachia. No one else has a proposed law out there that would end the nightmare that is mountaintop removal. Only the ACHE Act would do that, and it will only do that with your determined support. So ACHEACT.org. And if you want to go out and talk to people about the ACHE Act, nothing is better to do that with than to be wearing your Save the Endangered Hillbilly t-shirt, which you can get at ColeRiverMountainWatch.net. Now, this isn't a big pitch. We just happen to have a lot of folks in the Horn audience, the Horn family, the Horn commune, got to keep everybody happy here, who have purchased the t-shirt, and they will vouchsafe the fact that, yes, indeedy, it is a conversation starter. Here in the hills and hollers of almost level West by God, Virginia, it's occasionally a riot starter. Yeah, I've had more than a couple of people offer to take a swing at me when I was wearing my Save the Endangered Hillbilly t-shirt. And you can get that by going to crmw.net. It's very, very cheap. And wherever you go, people will ask you what it means. And that kind of opens the door for you to tell them about mountaintop removal and tell them about the ACHE Act and get them active, too. It reminds me of something that Kevin said by way of an email last night. He dropped a line toward the end of the program. I wasn't able to get to it because we had a stack up of calls toward the end of the show. And Kevin wanted to know the particulars of Dr. Bill's schedule. Dr. Bill, of course, live Monday through Wednesday from 4 to, don't confuse, I'm confused. How can you not be confused? Dr. Bill's live Monday through Wednesday, 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, except on the Mondays when he has a board meeting in the evening, when we will do what we did yesterday and go 3 to 5. That's the schedule as it stands now. So there we have that part of the process. Kevin also remarked in an email, he said, I meant what I said about the Horn and you, yourself. If not for your show, I never would have heard of the ACHE Act. I never would have learned anything about mountaintop removal or the struggle of the tribes in Wisconsin, among many other things. So I hope you are willing to take the information about mountaintop removal and about the ACHE Act and run with it, because we cannot do this without your help. And one other thing, I was reminded by our friends over at Earth Justice, who sent out a blast email not too long back, encouraging people, and you can do this too, and it's a great thing. Sit down and type a letter to the editor of your local newspaper, because you see, congressional staffs read the local newspaper almost religiously. And I'll bet you that most of your local newspapers have never heard of mountaintop removal. And I'll bet you that they darn sure don't expect anybody in your district to care about it. Because, of course, the coal industry worked very, very hard to make sure that that story never got out of Appalachia. We won that struggle. A lot of people know about it, but there's still a lot more to educate. If you feel inclined, and it costs you nothing but your time, sit down and write a letter to the editor of your local newspaper talking about mountaintop removal and asking your member of Congress to sign on to H.R. 526, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, the AHEC Act. You can suggest that your two senators sponsor it in the Senate so that we can begin to get relief for the people being beset by bizarre cancers, heart disease, lung disease, genitourinary conditions, birth defects, premature death. And when you do that, you will have the satisfaction of knowing that in the midst, in the face of a moral crisis of epic proportions, that instead of remaining silent in some perception of comfort, that you stood to be counted and took action. A couple of remarks, a note in from our buddy Tosh, going back to my remarks about Patrick's Day on Sunday. He says, you're completely correct that St. Patrick's Day effectively celebrates the elimination of paganism in Ireland. I spent a chunk of time researching at one point. I was thinking it would make a really interesting movie. I went far enough to have spent some time studying screenwriting and bought a copy of the Braveheart script as a sample. The big difference, according to what I can find of medieval histories, legends, is Patrick was kidnapped from his mid-level Roman-affiliated family, probably as a teenage boy, by Irish raiders. He was taken to Ireland, where he was sent out to watch sheep. I plan to write him mouthing off at the local laird. I'd also plan to throw a romantic theme in here where either a girl he liked or was betrothed to was taken into the service of the local laird, who then sent Patrick off into the country to watch sheep. Somewhere in there there's a where sheep are scared joke, but we'll leave that be. Legends have it that he was warned by the voice of God to split from his assignment as a shepherd just as men from the laird came to take him to be executed. He ran away and managed passage to France, where he got with God, with some early monks or so, and then decided to return to Ireland. Somehow the legends aren't clear, but he was able to do remarkable things similar to what the mages in the employ of the local kings could do. Eventually he talked the High King of Ireland into letting him start a church. My link to the snakes is very similar, Tosh says, to what you mentioned. The snakes referred to the pagan-style flags, snake-shaped flags, of the pagan local kings of Ireland. I guess you would call them pennants, perhaps. Not pennants, P-A-N-N-A-N-C-E, but pennants, P-E-N-N-A-N-T-S. Driving the snakes out refers to the slow and steady, possibly violent, elimination conversion of these kings to the new religion of, you know, peace and love. I added the peace and love part. Tosh says, as my religious fervor has subsided a bit, this project has moved from the back burner into the cupboard. Yeah, I don't think the movie's a bad idea, Tosh. Lord, I mean, don't sit down and watch an hour of it. Your brains will run out your nostrils if you do. But if that goober from Survivor can make a botch of the Bible, which was well, myths anyway. I guess you can take all the liberties you want, including up to making Satan out to be Barack Obama in a Sith robe. These are not the Kenyans you're looking for. Well, then giving Patrick a little forlorn love interest, I don't think would be out of the question, although Bill Donahue from the Catholic League might try to have you killed by his weirdo followers. Anyway, Tosh says, I don't know how much violence can be directly attributed to the rise of Patrick, but the green versus orange conflict since the English set their sights on ruling all the Isles has been significant. My mother's mother was right at the junction of this conflict within her family. I'm not quite sure how, but she was the eldest child of my great-grandfather's second wife. He had 17 children by two women. Busy man. And I suspect she was a Protestant and the older children were Catholic, as most Irish who got to the U.S. in the 1840s were. This caused massive conflict, which somehow ended up with her being sent to Barre, Vermont Seminary for 2 years. Am I mispronouncing that? B-A-R-R-E. Barre. Barre. Accent grave over the E. Pronounced xylophone. I don't know. I'll leave it to the Vermont contingent to correct me if I've got it wrong. Oddly enough, that would have made her one of the better educated folks in Vermont, certainly among the working class. Shanty Irish, they called themselves. She taught school for a while until she met and married my somewhat ignorant Baptist grandpa. The upshot of the whole conflict was my mother and grandmother were anti-church, though my parents did help found a Unitarian Universalist fellowship. I didn't know about that. I didn't know that about the penance. That those were the snakes. Tosh notes by way of conclusion, with green and orange elements in my family history, I usually ignore St. Patrick's Day. Thanks, Tosh. Now, there are an abundance of stories tonight, you know that. But in the name of the legions, you know, in Roman terminology, a legion was 1,000 soldiers or thereabouts. But in the name of the legions of dead, both American military and innocent Iraqi, and on the Iraqi side, it's anywhere between 200,000 and over 1 million, depending on whom you wish to give the most credence. In the name of that unspeakably horrible bloodshed, that eternal blot on what passes for the conscience of the country, we're not going to run off into Titanic Tuesday, at least not yet. As was said in Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, attention must be paid. Attention must be paid. By now, considering the other progressive radio shows that have gone on in the day before this one comes on the air, I imagine there has been no small amount of coverage of this pornographic anniversary of cold-blooded murder, attempted genocide, certainly a raft of chargeable war crimes as thick as a ream of copy paper. And knowing that, I don't want to simply reel off the bloody statistics of George Bush's summary execution of Iraq. You know those. You know the number of dead. You know the mendacious and felonious lies that were told to get it started. You know how Colin Powell flushed his own career and whatever was left of his honor down the toilet to do George's bidding. You know the things that Richard B. Dick Big Time Cheney said. You know the remarks of the comb-licking, oh, who was that creepy bastard? The comb sucker. You know who I'm talking about. Anyway, you know all of that. And while I am not often inclined to read long form, this rather begs for it. When I was out in Wisconsin last September for Fighting Bob, Phil Donahue was there, and he screened a deeply moving documentary called Body of War. It's the story of Thomas Young's return home from Iraq. And it is available out there for your viewing. I read something a week or so ago by Chris Hedges, a follow-up on the story of Thomas Young. It is called The Crucifixion of Thomas Young. Hedges writes, I flew to Kansas City last week to see Thomas Young. Young was paralyzed in Iraq in 2004. He is now receiving hospice care at his home. I knew him by reputation in the movie documentary Body of War. He was one of the first veterans to publicly oppose the war in Iraq. He fought as long and as hard as he could against the war that crippled him until his physical deterioration caught up with him. I'd been toying with the idea of suicide for a long time because I'd become helpless, he told me, in his small house on the Kansas City outskirts where he intends to die. I couldn't dress myself. People have to help me with the most rudimentary of things. I decided I did not want to go through life like that anymore. The pain, the frustration. He stopped abruptly and called his wife. Claudia, can I get some water? She opened a bottle of water, took a swig so it would not spill when he sipped, and handed it to him. I felt at the end of my rope, the 33-year-old Army veteran went on. I made the decision to go on hospice care, to stop feeding and fade away. This way, instead of committing the conventional suicide, and I'm out of the picture, people have a way to stop by or call and say their goodbye. I felt this was a fairer way to treat people than to just go out with a note. After the anoxic brain injury in 2008, a complication that Young suffered, he says, I lost a lot of dexterity and strength in my upper body, so I wouldn't be able to shoot myself or even open the pill bottle to give myself an overdose. The only way I could think of doing it was to have Claudia open the pill bottle for me, but I didn't want her implicated. Chris Hedges writes, after you made that decision, how did you feel? I felt relieved, he answered. I finally saw an end to this 4.5-year fight. If I were in the same condition I was in during the filming of Body of War, in a manual chair, able to feed and dress myself and transfer from my bed to the wheelchair, you and I would not be having this discussion. I can't even watch the movie anymore because it makes me sad to see how I was compared to how I am. Viewing the deterioration, I decided it was best to go out now rather than regress more. Chris Hedges writes, Young will die for our sins. He will die for a war that should never have been fought. He will die for the lies of politicians. He will die for war profiteers. He will die for the careers of generals. He will die for a cheerleader press. He will die for a complacent public that made war possible. He bore all this upon his body. He was crucified, and there are hundreds of thousands of other crucified bodies like his in Baghdad and Kandahar and Peshawar and Walter Reed Medical Center. Mangled bodies and corpses. Broken dreams. Unending grief. Betrayal. Corporate profit. These are the true products of war. Thomas Young is the face of war. They do not want you to see. On April 4th, 2004, Young was crammed into the back of a 2.5-ton army truck with 20 other soldiers in Sadr City, Iraq. Insurgents opened fire on the truck from above. It was like shooting ducks in a barrel, he said. A bullet from an AK-47 severed his spinal column. A second bullet shattered his knee. At first, he did not know he had been shot. He felt woozy. He tried to pick up his M16. He couldn't lift his rifle from the truck bed. That was when he knew something was terribly wrong. I tried to say, "I'm going to be paralyzed. Someone shoot me right now." But there was only a hoarse whisper that came out because my lungs had collapsed, he said. I knew the damage. I wanted to be taken out of my misery. His squad leader, Staff Sergeant Robert Miltenberger, bent over and told him he would be all right. A few years later, Young would see a clip of Miltenberger weeping as he recounted the story of how he had lied to Young. "I tried to contact him," said Young, whose long red hair and flowing beard make him look like a biblical prophet. "I can't find him. I want to tell him it is okay." Young had been in Iraq 5 days. It was his first deployment. After being wounded, he was sent to an army hospital in Kuwait. And although his legs, now useless, lay straight in front of him, he felt as if he was still sitting cross-legged on the floor of the truck. That sensation lasted for about 3 weeks. It was an odd and painful initiation into his life as a paraplegic. His body, from then on, would play tricks on him. He was transferred from Kuwait to the U.S. military hospital at Landstuhl, Germany, and then to Walter Reed in Washington, D.C. He asked if he could meet Ralph Nader, and Nader visited him in the hospital with Phil Donahue. Donahue, who had been fired by MSNBC a year earlier for speaking out against the war, would go on with Ellen Spiro to make the 2007 film Body of War. A brutally honest account of Young's daily struggle with his physical and emotional scars of war. In the documentary, he suffers dizzy spells that force him to lower his head into his hands. He wears frozen gel inserts in a cooling jacket because he cannot control his body temperature. He struggles to find a solution to his erectile dysfunction. He downs fistfuls of medications, carbamazepine for nerve pain, Coumadin, a blood thinner, to Xanadine, an antispasm medication, gabapentin, another nerve pain medication, bupropion, an antidepressant, omeprazole for morning nausea, and morphine. His mother has to insert a catheter into his penis. He joins Cindy Sheehan at Camp Casey in Crawford, Texas, to protest with Iraq veterans against the war. His first wife leaves him. You know, you see a guy who's paralyzed and in a wheelchair, and you think he's just in a wheelchair, he says in Body of War. You don't think about the stuff inside that's paralyzed. I can't cough because my stomach muscles are paralyzed, so I can't work up the full coughing energy. I'm more susceptible to urinary tract infections, and there's a great big erection sidebar to this whole story. In early March 2008, a blood clot in his right arm, the arm that bears a color tattoo of a character from Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are, caused his arm to swell. He was taken to the Kansas City Veterans Affairs Hospital, where he was given the blood thinner, Coumadin, before being released. 1 month later, the VA took him off of Coumadin, and soon afterward, the clot migrated to one of his lungs. He suffered a massive pulmonary embolism and fell into a coma. When he awoke from the coma in the hospital, he could barely speak. He had lost most of his upper body mobility and short-term memory. His speech was slurred significantly. It was then that he began to experience debilitating pain in his abdomen. The hospital would not give him narcotics because such drugs slow digestion, making it harder for the bowels to function. Young could digest only soup and jello. In November, in a desperate bid to halt the pain, he had his colon removed. He was fitted with a colostomy bag. The pain disappeared for a few days and then came roaring back. He could not hold down food, even pureed food, because his stomach opening had shrunk. The doctors dilated his stomach. He could eat only soup and oatmeal. 3 weeks ago, he had his stomach stretched again. And that was enough. I will go off the feeding tube after me and my wife's anniversary, April 20th, the date on which he married Claudia in 2012. I was married once before. It didn't end well. It was a non-amicable divorce. At first I thought I would wait for my brother and his wife, my niece, and my grandparents to visit me, but the one thing I will miss most in my life is my wife. I want to spend a little more time with her. I want to spend a full year with someone without the problems that plagued my previous marriage. I don't know how long it'll take when I stop eating. If it takes too long, I may take steps to quicken my departure. I've saved a bottle of liquid morphine. I can down that at one time with all my sleeping medication. Young's room is painted a midnight blue and has a large cutout of Batman on one wall. He loved the superhero as a child because he was a regular person who had a horrible thing happen to him and wanted to save society. Young joined the army immediately after 9/11 to go to Afghanistan and hunt down the people behind the attacks. He did not oppose the Afghanistan war. In fact, if I'd been injured in Afghanistan, there would be no body of war movie to begin with, he said, but he never understood the call to invade Iraq. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, we didn't invade China just because they looked the same, he said. He became increasingly depressed about his impending deployment to Iraq when he was in basic training at Fort Benning, Georgia. He asked the battalion doctor for antidepressants. The doctor said he had had to meet first with the unit's chaplain, who told him, I think you'll be happier when you get over to Iraq and start killing Iraqis. That was the chaplain who said that. That's me editorializing. The chaplain, the follower of Jesus Christ, the Prince of Peace. Right? I think you'll be happier when you get over to Iraq and start killing Iraqis. Young said I was dumbstruck by his response. He has not decided what will be done with his ashes. He flirted with the idea of having them plowed into ground where marijuana would be planted, but then wondered if anyone would want to smoke the crop. He knows there will be no clergy at the memorial service held after his death. It'll be just people reminiscing over my life, he said. I spend a lot of time sitting here in my bedroom watching TV or sleeping, he said. I've found, I don't know if it's the result of my decision or not, it is equally hard to be alone or to be around people. This includes my wife. I'm rarely happy. Maybe it's because when I'm alone, all I have with me are my thoughts, and my mind is a very hazardous place to go. When I'm around people, I feel as if I have to put on a facade of being the happy little soldier. He listens, when he's well enough, to audiobooks with Claudia. Among them have been Al Franken's satirical book Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, and Michael Moore's The Official Fahrenheit 9/11 Reader. He was a voracious reader but can no longer turn the pages of a book. He finds some solace in the French film The Intouchables about a paraplegic and his caregiver, and The Sessions, a film based on an essay by the paralyzed poet Mark O'Brien. to recover the page. Here we go. Young, when he was in a wheelchair, found that many people behaved as if he was mentally disabled or not even there. When he was being fitted for a tuxedo for a friend's wedding, the salesman turned to his mother. His mother. And asked her in front of him whether he could wear the company's shoes. I look at the TV through the lens of his eyes and can see he is invisible, said Claudia, standing in the living room as her husband rested in the bedroom. An array of books on death, the afterlife, and dying are spread out around her. No one is sick on television. No one is disabled. No one faces death. Dying in America is a very lonely business. If I had known then what I know now, Young said, I would not have gone into the military. But I was 22, working various menial jobs, waiting tables, working in the copy department of an Office Max. My life was going nowhere. September 11th happened. I saw us being attacked. I wanted to respond. I signed up 2 days later. I wanted to be a combat journalist. I thought the military would help me out of my financial rut. I thought I could use the GI Bill to go to school. Young is not the first young man to be lured into war by false sirens of glory and honor, and then callously disregarded by the war makers. His story has been told many times. It's the story of Hector in the Iliad, the story of Joe Bonham, the protagonist in Dalton Trumbo's 1939 novel, Johnny Got His Gun, whose arms, legs, and face are blown away by an artillery shell, leaving him trapped in the inert remains of his body. Bonham ruminates in the novel, Inside me, I'm screaming. Nobody pays any attention. If I had arms, I could kill myself. If I had legs, I could run away. If I had a voice, I could talk and be some kind of company for myself. I could yell for help. But nobody would help me. For Young, the war, the wound, the paralysis, the wheelchair, the anti-war demonstrations, the wife who left him and the one who didn't, the embolism, the loss of motor control, the slurred speech, the colostomy, the IV line for narcotics implanted in his chest, the open bed sores that expose his bones, the despair, the crushing despair, the decision to die, have come down to a girl, Alexis, his only niece. She will not remember her uncle, but he lies in his dimly lit room, painkillers flowing into his broken body, and he thinks of her. He does not know exactly when he will die, but it must be before her second birthday, in June. He will not mar that day with his death. And though he is an atheist, though he believes that there is nothing after death, that, as he says, the body is like a toy that runs out of batteries, only there are no replacements, his final act honors the promise of Alexis's life. As he spoke to me softly of this child, it hurts even now, he said, to know that she will grow up without him. I wondered, sitting next to him on his bed, if he saw it, the glory of it. His final bow, not before the specter of his death, but the sanctity of her life, the resurrection. It is difficult not to sit here. And I won't even attempt it. It is difficult not to sit here and pretend not to simply hate George Bush and Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell and the whole filthy, literally, if he exists, God-forsaken crew that cooked up this now 10-year-old debacle. One usually reserves one's fondest wishes and hopes for the well-being of one's loved ones, one's family, and mine are so reserved. But not far down the list is my fondest hope, among my fondest hopes, is that someday, somehow, million to one Powerball lottery odds to one against, that someday George Bush, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Donald Rumsfeld, Colin Powell will know justice. The human coin has on its face mercy, and on its obverse, or on its reverse, on the other side of the coin is justice. Mercy and justice. George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Donald Rumsfeld, Colin Powell, and that blood-sodden crew are fully entitled plank owners, as the saying goes, of justice. And they are entitled to every bit of the mercy that they showed to human beings in their hundreds of thousands, perhaps even in their millions, in Iraq. They are entitled to precisely that much mercy, and the quantum of that mercy is, of course, zero.
Say that it can never happen here. like it. Fear rules a mob. You print your truth, you lose your job. The cream will mix it, safe for you. It's death for many, riches for the few. And you say that it can never happen here. And you say that it can never happen here.
Kuntz. It can never happen here. The album that's on is by the same name. But it did happen here, and it was no accident. And yes, the comb sucker, of course, Paul Wolfowitz. Paul Wolfowitz, who spoke to the graduating class of the United States Military Academy on June the 11th, 2001, when he told the graduating class, referencing Pearl Harbor, I can't tell you what's going to happen, but something is going to be happening, and the best you can do is be ready for it. If Dante is to be believed, the lowest level of hell is reserved for the betrayers. That's where he said in his Inferno that Judas hangs out. If that's the case, then surely, there'll be plenty of space for Dick Cheney and George Bush and the whole cadre of homicidal maniacs who started that nightmare war. And, of course, there were a lot of enablers in the Congress. The list really too long to recite at this point in time. Almost all the Republicans and way too many Democrats jumped on board. I saw a post on my Facebook page today. Apparently, our buddy Michael, Kid A in the chat room when he wanders in, was listening to Ed Schultz earlier today. And I don't know the precise context. If, Michael, if you're listening live, you can certainly write in and tell us what that context was. Well, darn. I'm sorry, Billy. I'm told there's no Bob Kincaid at the dinner table. Well, I've ruined my fair share of meals, and this is probably not easy. I understand. But trying to find it here. This note from Michael. Because I guess Ed Schultz talked about this at some length today. Not surprising. I'm going to give it one more look through here. Oh, there it is. Michael wrote earlier today and tagged me on Facebook. No, Ed, I do not feel stupid, because I was not one of the vast majority of gullible Americans who supported the Iraq invasion 10 years ago today. I knew it was bullshit when Bush went to the UN and blatantly exploited the first anniversary of 9/11 to urge war against Iraq. I knew it was bullshit when Colin Powell waved around scary prop vials of anthrax and testified to the UN about chemical weapon labs hidden inside good humor trucks roving around Baghdad. I knew it was bullshit when Condi and Dick started yapping about smoking guns and mushroom clouds. And I knew it was bullshit when the weapons inspectors said, hey, this is bullshit. So if I ever hear anything about yellow cake or aluminum tubes again, I'll call bullshit again. If you feel stupid, Ed, that's your problem. Because that's a trend that I've noticed. A sort of collective, our bad, sorry, oopsie. Oh, gosh, the entire American nation was led into a war that was based on tissue paper thin lies. Well, we won't do that again. Except for the fact that there were literally hundreds of thousands of people who took to the streets in various places all over this planet to protest this war. And they are not culpable. You opposed this war. I opposed this war. And to watch a nation go to war when you know better is to know a level of impotent fury that few other situations can engender. You were there. You haven't had a change of heart. We knew the war was wrong from its outset, and we railed against it. I watched my World War II veteran father come near tears as I had seen him outside of immediate death in his own family over this. Because he knew, that old water tender from below the waterline of an aircraft carrier in the South Pacific, he knew that it was lies, all lies. He knew. Millions of us knew. And in that moment when the decision was made to go to war against Iraq on a pretext of lies that everyone involved, from those who wanted it to those who didn't, knew were lies, in that moment, I think we knew better than in any other time that representative government in the United States of America had died. And it ain't been resurrected yet either. It's still dead. And the likes of John Boehner, who of course supported the war in Iraq, intend to see that it stays dead. The only representative government we're allowed to have anymore is the government that is of the corporations, by the corporations, for the corporations. The government that is of the Koch brothers, by the Koch brothers, for the Koch brothers. The government that is of the Carlyle Group, by the Carlyle Group, for the Carlyle Group. The government that is of Halliburton, by Halliburton, and for Halliburton. There is blame in abundance. Just got a blast email from Dennis Kucinich. He says, I've called for a process of truth and reconciliation. Good luck. And I mean that sincerely. I'd like to see it happen. Where those who were responsible for taking us to war are brought forth in an officially sanctioned setting. And under oath, testify to what they knew. The American people must know the truth about the grave decision made by our government to go to war. The families of U.S. servicemen and women who made the ultimate sacrifice deserve to know the truth. The families of dead Iraqi civilians who died as a result of the war deserve to know the truth. 10 years after the war, Iraq is still in turmoil. 10 years after the war, the United States' financial security is threatened by the cost of the war, and our long-term physical security has been damaged by the war. How can we recover? How can the people of Iraq recover? How can the world recover? We must demand the truth. We must know the truth. Truth and reconciliation is the process. It has worked in other countries struggling with their past. It can work in America. Interesting. I mentioned the concept of truth and reconciliation on this program just a few nights ago. Seems to have a cachet of applicability, doesn't it? Yeah. Dennis Kucinich was right about the Iraq War. He said that it was a pack of lies. And guess what? It was a pack of lies. Interestingly, however, when the for-profit media got a chance to discuss it, they asked him whether he had ever seen a UFO. For-profit media, what would we do without you? I know what. We might begin to draw to rebuild a structure of moral, ethical journalism to replace the cheap stenographers that the Fourth Estate proved itself to be in large measure, not in its entirety, but in large measure during the shameful run-up to that filthy, blood-sodden disaster. But it does bear remembering. The people, in the face of withering criticism, in the face of howling calls for the head of Iraq, spit it upon a pike. It does bear remembering